Welcome everyone to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their enriching stories about lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host, and today we're exploring our non-fiction library of fascinating topics. So please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome to Friday's Goldster Inside Story, the second show in a fascinating week about social interaction. How to get out there, how to meet people, how to know how to trust them, and how to walk away when you want or need to. And welcome also to our audience of the future, who will be listening to this conversation sometime in the future on a Goldster Inside Story podcast. Just Google Goldster podcast and an array of wonderful shows will spread out in front of you, and this one shortly. Now, those of you with us yesterday would have met Lena Sisko and her lessons on how to detect lying and dishonesty. Today, we have an equally brilliant colleague from SPIEx. That's a network of incredibly highly skilled experts who have worked in America's military intelligence and security agencies and bring what they have learned to our everyday lives. My guest's latest book is called Sizing People Up. One of the most important skills anyone can have, especially as in Goldster people, they're moving into new stages of life, empty nesting, retiring from the day job, yearning to seek new horizons. Now, our Goldster experts here are the best in the field dealing with global high stakes issues. But yesterday with Lena, we had a hypothetical everyday walking group where we found common ground on these high stakes global issues. Today, I will be asking my guest to imagine that we're talking about the committee on the Village Flower Show. And without further ado, welcome Robin Dreet to Goldster Inside Story.
Thank you, Humphrey, so much for having me on. I have my goosebumps on my arms going for the excitement I have to be on and sharing with your amazing audience, both now and, as you said, in the future.
Now, tell me, do they have Village Flower Shows in America, or are we on the right platform there?
You know, I think it depends on the village. So the little town my parents live in Connecticut, yes, they still do those things in the Village Green down there. And probably not my town here where I'm in Virginia, but up there they do, yes.
And in that little town, say, where your parents are, we're getting with our hypotheticals matching reality. You have people who feel that their reputations are at stake, that might not be telling the truth. A bit of backstabbing, and then a bit of collaborative, a bit of the transactional, all that stuff goes on.
Yeah, it does. And the challenge in those things that people often don't realize is that all we're always seeking in every interaction is to feel safe. It really is the bedrock of everything we do in life, which is the foundation of trust and what Lena was talking about yesterday about detecting deception. How do you make someone around you feel safe? And when we feel insecure ourselves and we suffered wounds or trauma in our lives, a lot of times you get very defensive. And so we see all these behaviors playing out around us. But really the core of everything is we want to feel safe, and to have great, healthy, strong relationships is foundational if we want to move forward in anything.
It's to make those around you feel safe. 100%. Even if perhaps you don't. And I'm going to throw at you right now a couple of tips that you have from your work. And I'm going to ask you, Robin, are you happy in yourself?
I am.
Even though it's 7 in the morning?
I am. It's any day you can get up and enjoy a great conversation and be a part of someone's life in a positive, healthy way, that is a successful day for me. So yes, I am happy in myself because that is my goal every single day. Very, very in the now.
And those people that aren't happy with themselves, that maybe feel the world isn't as safe as they would like it to be, are these the people that think, oh, there's Robin Dreet, he's more successful than me, or he did a bad thing to me, or why is this pothole in the road here, or the workman, give us an idea of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, as we've seen in society, everything's a dichotomy. It's a balance between two things, because without one side, you don't have an understanding of what the other is, you know, like good with bad. You can't understand how great something is unless you experience some horrendous things, or you at least see it around you. And the same thing with people that are viewing life in a negative way. I said it before we started, they're called wound collectors. These are people that see life and give a negative framing and context to everything around them, which makes them have the really horrible self-destructive emotions like animosity, vengeance. They are angry, resentful. Resentful is probably the most horrendous one we can feel. And so these people tend to think the world owes them and that it's out to get them, rather than being problem solvers and just knowing that the world is what it is and what are you going to do about it to move forward and solve problems. And so unfortunately, people fall into one of those two camps.
You mentioned problems there, and one of your other tips, and we're going to get into this in more detail later, is do you look for problems, Robin? Because you advise us against looking for problems.
Yeah, and that goes into a great human condition as well, is we are what we consume. I mean, we've probably all heard the cliche, you are what you eat. You are what you consume. And if you are doing nothing but consuming negative things, negative energy, negative news, it's going to embody you. I mean, who hasn't walked out of a movie in a cinema and it was a really uplifting one? And you walk out and you feel like $1 million. If you walk out of a Rocky movie or something, you want to walk out and you feel like you can go run a couple miles, and then it kind of fades away. Same thing when you read a book. You read a great book and you're really uplifted and you feel really good and you want to solve problems if it's a mystery or something. If you're consuming negative things, it's going to do exactly the same thing to you. And if you're constantly surrounding yourself with negative energy and negative thoughts, it's going to consume who you are. You need to really balance out and bring in some positive to what you're trying to do.
Well, that must have impacted us all in the past few years, because if you look at the news cycles, everything is negative, whether it's a war going on, whether it's a crash, or whether it's our politicians who, you know, are grandparents' generation or parents' generation would generally trust are now ripping each other apart. That's all negativity, isn't it?
100%. 100%. And unfortunately, I go back to where I think the origin of this was, is when I remember when cable was invented, you know, I know you do too, was, you know, when we were growing up, there was 5 channels on our television and you had to turn the dial, and the news was on for about 30 minutes a day at night and very few commercials, because it was mandated by the government that you had to put a public service announcement on there in order to have an FCC license. And so there was no marketing or advertising, because it was something they had to do because they knew it was boring, it was informative, but the marketers wouldn't sell ad space on there. Then along comes cable news and a 24-hour news cycle that they now have to pay for a staff. They have to pay for overhead because that was their main thing. And so now we have to satisfy the human condition of looking for trauma, looking for disaster. It's why, you know, race car shows are like this, because you're waiting for the crash. Yeah. And so that's what sells. And unfortunately, that's what they keep trying to one-upsmanship on, is the trauma they're going to show. And so that becomes a huge part of what people consume, unfortunately.
Yeah, so I mean, we touch on this a lot in our discussions, but this is having an impact in our society as a whole. But I just want to ask you this question about the problem hunting or solving thing. What is the difference between looking for problems around you and assessing danger around you to make sure that everything's as safe as can be?
Yeah, they can be overlapping. There's a lot of Venn diagrams where you have overlap between the two, but looking for problems rather than looking for solutions is a mindset, and feeling safe is just being really aware. And they're separate, but they're overlapping. So feeling safe is our ability to be calm and present. Presence is so important with everything that we do. I mean, you're a world-renowned traveler, interviewer, and everything. And in order for you to be successful in those environments, you have to have been completely present to see, to hear, to observe what is with the utmost challenge in the world, and that is letting go of your own confirmation bias of what you think you're seeing and just seeing what is. And so what we're doing when we're trying to feel safe is taking in that environment. If you want to feel safer, that's what you need to do. Be completely present, as opposed to problem solving, which is then look for the positive, look for how to move forward.
A lot of that feeds into an issue that I'm going to going to get to, I want to go back now and look at your FBI background, but to go back to is one of your big things is curiosity, is that the more curious you are, the sort of safer you can be because you know everything around you. But I'd like to sort of start at a bit a tangent because in the news here yesterday, well, in 2017, there was a suicide bomb attack at a concert in Manchester with more than 20 dead, hundreds were injured by an Islamic terrorist. And yesterday, our domestic intelligence service, MI5, apologized publicly for missing leads that might have been able to affect it. MI5's official name is the Security Service, and quite often it's compared and said that it's the equivalent to the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation in America. But they're not exactly the same, are they, Robin? Could you give us the difference?
You bet. I've had the great privilege of working a lot with both MI5, MI6, and what we call the Five Eye partners around the world, because I did nothing but counterintelligence in my FBI career. It was all about recruiting spies and protecting the national security of the United States and our NATO ally partners. So what MI5 does and how it compares to the FBI is really, really simple. What I did inside the FBI, working nothing but counterintelligence, which is domestic security service, is exactly what MI5 did. My job was, when I was in New York City, I call it covered because my job was to monitor all the hostile threat nations that did not have the best interests of the United States and our allies at heart, like Russia and China, top two right there, and to try to recruit their intelligence officers that are serving under diplomatic cover in the United States. That's the primary mission. MI5, very, very similar, and also has a domestic security service working counterterrorism. The difference is the FBI is a combination of MI5 as well as Scotland Yard, because we also do criminal investigations where they're doing money laundering, they're doing hijackings if it crossed state lines. And so it's really that combination of an investigative criminal arm as well as a counterintelligence arm. So it's basically Scotland Yard and MI5 combined.
Okay, so what you were doing pretty much matches what the guys were doing that were trying to stop all these Manchester-type bombings. Yes. And have had a great deal of success in it. It's the one that gets through that we all notice, of course.
Right.
And then the FBI agents that we see in the movies and everything, those are more like the police, but they're federal, aren't they? They can go anywhere in the U.S. as opposed to this in a particular state.
Right. And also not reactive. You know, you have first responders that are the local police departments and the state police departments that are first on the scene, secure the scene, make people safe, take care of that kind of thing. And then you have the investigators show up, which is the FBI, to kind of do the more deep dive investigations. And a lot of times, if it's a more of a local jurisdiction crime, they'll call on the FBI to provide resources like the behavioral analysis units or my program, the behavioral analysis program, to help understand the types of people that would do this type of crime so we can go out and kind of find them.
I see. And I think in our case, it's the Metropolitan Police. That's essentially the London police force. But that handles terror all over the country in conjunction with MI5. But thank you for that, because it actually brings me right to the next question to ground you so that we know who we're talking to. You became head of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analyst Program or unit.
Right.
What is behavioral analysis?
Behavioral analysis is really understanding people, plain and simple, understanding people and their motivations for life. And everyone's got different ways they enact that. But what I found with my program, what we did was we strategized as a team human interaction. It was spy recruitment cases. It was espionage investigations, false flag operations, double agent operations, all that, as I call it, hooky spooky spy stuff. If we had a case agent as working one of these cases somewhere in our country and sometimes internationally, if they were at a stumbling block or roadblock of how to move forward with this human interaction aspect of it, they'd call me and I'd assemble a very specific team with different expertise of other case agents and an operational psychologist. And we'd come in and we'd look at the human condition, look at how to strategize engaging with management to get the approval to move forward with the case, as well as how the individual, the case agent, him or herself, was going to engage the human being to do the most important thing to inspire someone to take action, trust. When I came out with my second book, I did that step back and realized, what are we doing as a behavioral team when we're doing behavioral analysis? What's the whole point of it? And all I ever did every day, and what all of us do, whether you're on the village green at the flower show or working with our wives and children or looking for that next thing in our career, all we're ever doing is strategizing. How can I both trust someone else and inspire someone to trust me so we can move forward together?
So you and I, we had a 10-minute conversation a couple of days ago. We're having a conversation now. If you were reporting back on me, what would you, is there a particular profile category that you would put me into?
Oh, see, I don't categorize. I'd look for your motivations and your pain points and the things that motivate you. And so, you know, Humphrey, it'd be really, really simple. A quick swath. And you're like, so before I came on the show, I did a quick Google of Humphrey. I went to your background. I saw how world traveled you are, some of the challenging situation you've been through in life. And yet you still bring the smile to the table. Your preparation is vast and in depth. You understand how the flow of things work. So I have someone that I'm communicating with that has a great depth of field, a great deep understanding of human behavior, yet has the humility to make it about someone else other than themselves. You are at the mastery level of human interaction. And so you... Well, that's how I see you. And so that makes me very excited. So I get the goosebumps even just saying to chat with someone like you, because you know how to forge great trust and relationships. So anyone that you then refer to me, or an option or an opportunity you give to me personally or with anyone else, if they're to ask me, say, hey, Humphrey asked me to come on the show, or Humphrey has this this option I can do in life. What's your take, Rob? I'm going to say 100% do it.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to say anything more on that because I'll just take that and I won't even thank you because I know that's a professional assessment.
There you go.
What fun we're having. If anybody wants to have their behavior analyzed, I might bring you in at the end to have a one-on-one with Robin if we get that. We have a question from with my crazy computer here. I will read it in a second. From Angie, Robin, your career has spanned both analog and digital modes of investigation. Give us a flavor of just how seismic a change the advent of digital tech has been. Yeah, interesting question.
It is an interesting question. So here's what's really great about, especially in the world when you're working with the folks that are around, you know, our group at SpyX or anyone else. It is the second oldest profession is the world of spying. And we all know what the first one is. And both have the human component as front and foremost, no matter what. All the skills, tools, and techniques and tradecraft employed with everything in life still comes down to human interaction. So yes, technology gives us an ability to communicate in faster and easier ways. I mean, just look at this great conversation. This conversation, Humphrey, would never have happened 10 years ago. Because we have the ability now with technology, so it can be a very good thing, to communicate globally. Very fascinating. Can you imagine the pandemic without Zoom?
Yeah.
Just like it was, you know, back during the Spanish flu, you know, in the early 1900s. It was horrendous. As bad as the pandemic was and COVID was on everyone psychologically and mentally, it was much worse in those time periods. But luckily, so I'm a problem solver. I see things as half full. Technology is fantastic. As long as you're using it to consume healthy content and using it to communicate in a healthy way with others. So changing the dynamic of spycraft, it's added a component, but still the core of everything that we do for tradecraft is exactly the same because it's all human-based.
But the other point, I think, is that we talk about the news cycles and the social media, where this element, and I've got a note from you here, you know, the reality is very few people are looking to hurt you. This is what you've written. And, right. You know, that we all have this sense of good in us or trying to help people. But in social media, it's different, isn't it? So there are these two parallel worlds?
No, the motivation that we all have is to be accepted, valued, and heard. And what happens is that if you don't feel someone's accepting you, valuing, hearing you the way that you want to be, and again, if you're seeing life as negative, if you're a wound collector, and now if you're giving yourself a negative confirmation bias with the information you're looking for, and I'm sure Lena even talked about this yesterday, if you're looking for deception, you're going to see nothing but deception. You have to look for communication. And then assess, is it positive, negative, deception, or truth? And so the same thing with media. If you're looking for something to be negative, you'll find it. But if you're looking for the positive, you're going to find that as well. The real problem with social media right now is people are using it as a substitute for this. And even though we're not in person, at least we have a lot of human interaction here. We can look at each other's nonverbals. And I'm not looking for you to click a like button because people get addicted to, I think I always do this analogy. It takes like 100 likes on any social media platform to equal one. Hey, really nice job today, Humphrey. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, that would be. Whilst you were talking there, I had an idea. We often do these off the hoof things for the audience. You're looking at Robin here. You're listening to him. He's giving you tips. Put into the chat what you think is behavioral analyze Robin and tell us, would you like him to be the chairman of the Village Flower Show committee? Would you like him to be kicked out? Or what do you think? How do you think he would fare in one of those things?
My insecurities are now spiking up too. Now I'm fearful.
let's see what happens there. Or ask any questions you want, of course, about this, because we are having fun, but it's a very serious topic. And you actually say that it's the most important thing to know, isn't it? To be able to size somebody up.
Absolutely. You know, and the importance of sizing people up, the name of the book can be a misnomer. You think you're really judging someone else. And what you're doing is you're assessing where someone's at in the relationship with you. Because what happens is if we set a bar for someone, we have an expectation here and they fall short of it because we were lazy in understanding what they saw when they saw us. In other words, empathy. If they fall short of what our expectations are, we get those negative emotions. If we take the time to figure out where they are in regards to us in the relationship, we can manage our expectations and we know exactly where they are. They're either going to exceed it. And if they fall short of it, because we did some due diligence in our own mind to look at how they're seeing us, we now can see that, oh, something must have happened. Maybe there's a challenge and a pain point in their life that I was unaware of. So let me dive a little bit deeper to try to be a resource for them. So it helps us in here to have a good, healthier relationship when we assess what someone sees when they're seeing us, which is really deep tactical empathy.
So this idea of curiosity, isn't it?
Oh my gosh.
You know, one of the things that I tell people when they ask me this is, you know, whenever you meet someone, always ask the follow-up question. You know, it's not, and don't keep loading on yourself. Give us a pen picture of curiosity, Robin, or how it should be used.
It's the bedrock of human interaction. We're born genetically and biologically for curiosity, for survival. And think back as children, we were so curious. Why is the sky blue? Why is the river running? What came first, the chicken or the egg? Why is that flower in the village green growing? Why is it that color? And we're tolerated for a certain amount of time because we're using that input as a child to make the world safe around us. So we understand it, so we can interact with it. And then as we start annoying our parents and the adults around us, if we're in an environment where people start squashing it, that curiosity gets stamped down for a while because they're saying, be quiet, just sit there, study like this. The healthiest people in the world were the ones that had people around them kept letting that curiosity flower. The greatest example, I think, of the power of curiosity, besides it gets you out of doors and it gets you engaging in the world, non-judgmental curiosity, which is one of my four pillars of communication. Go ahead. I see you have a question.
So non-judgmental curiosity, I mean, that's interesting. So if I was, for example, talking to Hitler, I would just keep asking him, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing it? As opposed to saying, I don't think you should be doing this.
Absolutely. And I would shift the question from why, because why gets an emotional response, which can be very subjective, to I'd ask what? What are you hoping to achieve by this? What do you think the outcome of this? Because what questions get people to be more specific and objective, and it gets them thinking. So absolutely. When you're in a profession like I was, and a lot of people I've had on a show, where you are interacting with people that have, from your context, committed the most heinous crimes against humanity. And if I'm going to sit across from this person and they think in any way I'm judging them, they're not going to share. They're not going to confess. They're not going to tell me how to save the children they molested. Or find out where they are. And so if you can't let go of your own negative confirmation bias when engaging this human being and at least discover what created them, because human beings are born. We all share a commonality in life, death, birth, and trauma. And that trauma at an early age, whatever that exposure is to challenging things, kinds of shapes who we are for the rest of our lives. Our job, if you're going to have a healthy interaction, is to understand what that was to create what you're seeing before you. Because once you understand it, you can then communicate effectively to move forward in whatever you're trying to achieve, whether it's confession, whether it's someone like Hitler to stop doing the heinous crimes against humanity. Yeah. So that's what non-judgmental curiosity is. It's not agreeing with someone, it's understanding what made them.
So what made bin Laden bring down the Twin Towers? What made Hitler do what? What's making Putin do what he's doing at the moment? And I mentioned the Twin Towers there because you begin with a very vivid scene of you meeting people that you worked with, you thought you knew, but actually the situation was totally different. So you had to reassess all that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, matter of fact, this is a piece of glass from the World Trade Center.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
My office was our building when I worked in New York City. I was there during 9/11, and I saw the first tower hit. I was watching the second tower hit. I saw 8 people jump from the North Tower before the second tower collapsed.
Yeah.
And my experience there was, it was, the humanity was amazing. We all see a different thing when we are from our individual context, and the support of humanity was tremendous. But what I saw internally inside my own organization, I felt that this amazing compulsion and weight of trying to save the world. Literally, you had people holding up signs every day saying, please find my daddy, please find my mommy, save us. And you feel this weight every day to do that, and feeling like you're not doing enough. And part of that, what I was doing was I was trying to recruit new confidential human sources to redirect from recruiting Russian spies to Middle East. Yeah. And part of this process, I came across, and I wrote about him in the book, one of my Russian sources gave me an individual that was related to a very high-ranking leader of another country in the Middle East. And we're going to have this great communication, this backdoor communication. But I had only had about, this happened in 2001. I came into the FBI in 1997, you know, so I didn't have a huge amount of time. And so what I first quickly found was, can I rapidly trust that this individual that I'm about to be introduced to is actually who he says he is? Can I trust that he can actually do and be a channel of information like he says he can? And even more importantly, how do I get my management to trust me at this low level to do this and still make them feel safe in their careers? Because that's the real key when working internal for management. People will often say someone got promoted and they changed. And I always say, no one's changed. They felt safe doing certain actions at this level that they no longer feel safe at this action at this level doing, because they're trying to feel safe in their careers. And so my job is to assess, how do I make them feel safe to tell me yes to move ahead?
That is a huge... an awful lot of layers that you're dealing with there. And in your behavioral analysis, you know, were you training people to do that? And you yourself were trained with all the nuances and outcomes that could come from it. You look too young to have been through all that, Robin.
No, it's a good, healthy living. training in that is no, it's interesting also. You know, Lena Sisko is a great example, and the other people you're having on, Jack Barsky coming up. Training gives us the ability at that low level of apprenticeship to learn how to get the repetitions in, as I call the reps in, so you can start hitting mastery level. And hitting a mastery level where you can actually interact like this, it's not training. That's on-the-job training. That's exposure, and that's repetition. I mean, the way you traveled the world and the things and the interactions and interviews you have conducted, no one trained you to do that. What you were trained in and what you were good at was learning how to embrace failure, reflect.
Right. Okay.
Reflect on when things went right, what I did well there, and then also reflect when it went sideways, what can own it. This is what problem solvers do, not wound collectors. It wasn't someone else's fault that it went sideways. I did something to cause them to not feel safe with me. What do I need to do differently next time? And so we learn the skills and the training to teach us how to get this repetition in and have teachers, mentors, and guides in our lives to move us forward to hit that level where we can start operating fluidly, because if we're thinking about the training, the things we have to do, that's one more second we're actually not paying attention to what the other person's doing.
Got you.
And so we have to be able to let go of the training and make it who we are.
And it becomes an instinctive experience, learning from mistakes. I'm going to ask you, if we have time on this, to tell us your biggest mistake, but we have, but before we do that, we have people behaviorally analyzing you. Angie says, I would have him as the marketing and PR person. Thank you. That's right. Pauline, I like Pauline's name. He looks into the camera, so that gives me confidence in him. He sits up straight. He answers your questions positively, so I feel I trust him. There you go. You've got a job there, Robin, with Pauline.
And smile. It's also another big one. Smile. I'm engaging the world in a positive way. Sometimes people ask me, so Robin, if you see a group of people, who do you approach first? The person who's smiling, because they're open for a conversation.
Oh, wonderful. Jackie, I think he would be fair, but would not tolerate any nonsense or allow anyone to dominate the meeting. You'd make a good chair then.
That's a really interesting assessment. That's very good. I'd be curious. My next question, follow up for her, is what made her think that?
Okay, who was asked that? Let me go back there.
That's a really
Jackie,
good observation.
Can you tell us what made you think that? Robin is curious, so he's showing us his curiosity.
and also present, because. And that this is a great example of not just, hey, that's the really nice thing. I heard her words. Those are very interesting words that kind of deviated from a norm of what people are saying. It's like, that kind of stood out a little bit. She's seen something a little bit deeper in a behavior of someone who's smiling, trying to be polite, not monopolize the conversation, although that's what I'm just doing now. But it's really interesting deviation. So that's what an example of being present is hearing the words that someone else says and then be curious about those words rather than trying to give you mine.
That's fascinating. We have one here that Anne Majo says, I'm absolutely a fanatic of Criminal Minds, BAU on TV. Are the series realistic? I think that's one of your colleagues, isn't it?
Yeah. So the BAUs and Criminal Minds, it is, we were in, so my program, there's a lot of behavioral programs inside the FBI and all across law enforcement. So the BAUs, behavioral analysis units, they have four of them. At least when I left, they had four of them, with each had different specialties. And they generally deal with abnormal psychology and criminal actions like murders, crimes against children, crimes against adults. They also deal with terrorism. And so it's abnormal psychology. And they're typically looking for people that they don't know who committed the crime. That's why they profile. My team, which is the behavioral analysis program, is a part of it and embedded, but we were very specific with counterintelligence operations, and we typically dealt with normal, healthy human interactions, because spies, they're highly educated, they're highly world-traveled, they're very curious people, they're operating, tend to be at a different level. 99% of the time, they're not committing crimes. They're going for open source information to compromise. And so it's kind of a different dynamic, all human focused and definitely working and collaborating together. But I always say it's, as a sphere, you have abnormal psych on one side, normal psych on the other. And so I was more on this side than that.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. And we've got a message here from Lisa Paul of SpyX, who actually says, yes, Jim Clementi, former FBI profiler, who was a guest about a year ago on our show. He's a technical advisor on 15 seasons of Criminal Minds. So yes, I think it is a true thing. We have a question from Emma here, who, how do you size up a person who shows you love and support overtly, but your inward self continues to doubt those expressions of love, maybe from the way they look at you? Do you only size up people from how they present to you, or do you have gut feelings about others? Is gut feeling important?
Oh, what a great question. So what you're seeing is, you're seeing, and you're picking up on this, and what a great job, and Emma was her name. You're picking up on incongruences. That gut feeling that sometimes people say, I just have this intuitive gut feeling towards people. What you're doing is you're seeing an incongruence between what they might be verbally saying and the emotion that they feel internally. So their nonverbals and their verbals become incongruent. They can be saying all the right things in the world, but their actions, words, and deeds and internally might be different. So, and what that looks like to us in general terms, they make me feel creepy. And so we're seeing an incongruence there. Now, here's the important thing. It doesn't mean someone's a bad person. It means either they're making a great effort to overcome who they are internally because they're working on themselves, or they are trying to manipulate you as well. You have no idea what that is. So the important thing is just to assess it, take note of it, and just keep observing and make your own decisions based on the level of trust you're willing to give someone who's not being completely transparent, because what you're seeing is a lack of transparency. Because the greatest thing we can do to forge trust, move forward, and solve problems is transparency, and that's open, honest communications. Two is using vulnerability, being transparent yourself. Those are two of the greatest things to overcome anything. And believe it or not, as a spy recruiter, I'm the first one I'll tell you, I did all I could to never lie, cheat, or deceive anyone, because it destroys trust.
And when you talk, when Emma talked about gut feeling there, that gut is what we were talking about before. It's the training piling into the instinct, piling into your curiosity. It's not just a sort of pure gut instinct.
Absolutely. A great point of this too, Humphrey. I've heard a lot of people that said, I'm just really good reading people. If I hear someone say that and they're actually pretty accurate on it, I can guarantee you this. This is someone who's actually had some early childhood trauma.
Yeah.
Because what happens at the early stages in our lives, we're trying to feel safe. And if you're in an environment that you don't feel safe in, you become really, really aware of the human cues around you that are going to be threatening. And so you become a great observer of human behavior and behaviors that make you feel unsafe. And so we carry that forward in life that makes us really, really good at reading people around us in safety.
Yeah. And that's, great. We have some other people. Now, Emma, who asked that question, I would have Robin as my psychologist teacher, and Pauline agrees. So you've hit Angie. Oh, but Robin stopped his flow because he read Humphrey wanting to ask a question. Ah, so you were anticipating me. You saw the way I was about to come in, and you held back without either of us saying anything. Pauline says, assertive in sentence structure. Josie, Eminence Grease is a good role for Robin. Eminence Grease. Jackie, direct eye contact. This is a wonderful compendium we're getting. Direct eye contact, quiet confidence in self, which gives members of the group a willingness to go the way the chair wishes. So yes, you could. Are you inadvertently steering my questions, Robin?
Never. I'm trying to make everyone feel safe.
And we're going from an interdependence in Homeland. If you watched it, could you have observed Carrie's psych profile bipolar helping or hindering her work as a CIA agent? I watched Homeland. Did you watch Homeland, Robin?
No, I didn't. It's a good question. I'll say it one more time because I think I can answer it.
Yeah, she was the star, but it was Emma says, Robin, you hit the nail on the head. I'm a great reader of people in general because of my childhood. I should have been a detective. There you go, Emma.
100%.
And Lillette, wow, so interesting about childhood trauma and the need to read people. I thought it was just my interest. You've obviously hitting in our committee of the Village Flower Show. we're hitting some points here. I wanted to go into some other elements that you talk to. There's two things. You talk us about the 10 positive tells for emotional stability. And then you talk about some tells of analyzing people before. For emotional stability, those people who show an abundance of appreciation, who are hard to scare, who are impeccably rational.
Yeah.
And then you talk about the code of trust. Wrap up those thoughts for us.
Oh, they're all this. Everything I've written is as everyone knows, life is not a destination, it's a journey. And so we embraced it today and the things we know today. Someone asked me the other day, you know, is there anything that you would have included in any of your books now that you didn't back then? In the moment back then, no, because they're a flow of where we currently are. It's kind of funny that my first book is about rapport, which is about quick you know, strategic, tactical, 5-minute rapport. The second one is about trust, which goes a little bit deeper about my behavior, and sizing people up is reversing it because I understood, wow, if I emanate trustworthy behaviors, someone else is going to trust me. So it's reading that. So it was an evolution. So all these things coming together, again, I'll just encapsulate is how do you make a conversation? How do you make any dialogue about the other person? How do you overcome, especially if you grow up with trauma? I had some great, fantastic trauma growing up, which made me exceptionally self-reliant and resilient, which is me focused. But the problem with that is that over a period of time, leadership is about others. Power is about self. It's about, look at me, it's popularity. I guarantee you the popular people in school growing up are too me focused. And it's not because they're bad. It's because most likely they had to do things to survive and feel safe. So that made them self-reliant and resilient. What happens is in some point in our life, we have to realize we have to be able to reverse the dialogue and make it about the other person, demonstrate to them that we value them, that we want to affiliate with them, and that they can feel safe with us. And I see you, I'm present. And there's four things. So I'm going to encapsulate all my books and everything I do in these four simple things to reverse the focus from yourself to others. Number one is seek the thoughts and opinions of others instead of sharing your own. Two, talk in terms of their priorities, challenges, and pain points instead of yours. Three, and we talked about this a lot, be non-judgmentally curious. Give the greatest gift in the world, be a Leonardo da Vinci, be a Benjamin Franklin, be an Einstein, and reverse the focus and make it and be curious about others. And finally, when appropriate, empower people with choices. When you do one of those four things, the entire shift goes from you to them. Their ancient tribal brain says, this person sees me, they value me, they make me feel good because they're present. And their brain says, trust.
And that's the thing is that there are people, I think, that we all meet who, whenever you talk about something, will always turn the conversation to themselves at some stage quite quickly. What is the name for that type of person?
That is someone who is insecure.
Yeah.
And what happens when people do that? I see some pain, and then I own my part. And so this is what's really important here, I think. If you see someone have an inappropriate behavior that is off-putting to you, what did you do to cause it? And this isn't like, oh, I'm always wrong. No, it's like what happened is it's not about you. They're not doing things to you. They're being who they are. Something, your presence in their lives some way flared up an insecurity, and they have to feel they're trying to prove themselves to you. They're trying to prove their worth to you. They're trying to prove that they're as good as you, to be in part of your tribe and in your circle. And so they name drop, they try to self-promote. Yeah. So all these inappropriate behaviors, they're a learned behavior because they're feeling insecure. So ask yourself this, if you want them to stop that behavior that's annoying to live in, but Jesus out of you, what can you do to inspire them to calm down, to feel safe? What can you do to make them feel accepted so they don't have this need to want to do these things? And yeah. So that's how we get through that. And at least understanding that they're not doing it to you helps you say, I understand why, and I can
own security mechanism. I mean, you have one of the tips here is, this is for the emotional stability, people who have power but don't love it.
Yes.
And that's what, when you said you don't need to name drop, you don't need to boast, you can just walk through whatever you're doing.
Isn't it more fun when we're sitting down and having a great conversation and you know the answers to a lot of things? Isn't it more fun to watch someone else's eyes light up when they share? I mean, literally, that is, it's one of the greatest things we do as a human being is to demonstrate that we value someone's contribution. It's so much more exciting to watch someone else be more excited than we are. It really is. So, and when you can get over yourself and your own insecurities, because granted, for most of my life, I was that person. I wanted to self-promote. I wanted to be, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. I can recruit all these spies. Look at me. And you know what? No one cares. They don't care about how you make them feel about you. They care about how you make them feel about themselves. And so if you're that person that can build someone else up, be of service to them, see them, that's who the world trusts.
So can we imagine our village show committee, and you are the new member, you've just moved into the village and you joined the committee. How do you balance the curiosity of being interested in the other people but also telling them about yourself, because people do want to know a little bit about you.
Sure.
What is that? Is it a 20%, 80%, or is it?
There's a couple of interesting things in there. When you are actually doing a really good job of asking what questions and being curious about people's origin story, I love discovering an origin story, just like you were doing and you have done. It's like, what forged this person and what's the thread in their life that led to today? When you start with that, getting people to be quiet is really hard. And them being interested in you generally doesn't happen all that much. But if they are, share. And then, because that transparency and openness, if people have a need and desire to feel safe because they need to know more about you, give them that gift of feeling safe and share. At the same time, they'll realize as soon as you start sharing, your dopamine in your brain starts kicking in because you're like, I'm being validated. I'm being accepted. I'm feeling great. Let me keep sharing. Be very, very attuned to when it's time to stop. Like, I've been monologuing a lot at you, and when and the very astute, you know, studio audience saw that I stopped mid-flow because your mouth went, because you had a question. It's like, oh, I'm too much. Let me stop. It's all about Humphrey again. And so you can't.
I think Angie sort of touched on this point. She says, Robin, I hear everything you're saying about conversation, but I probably overdo it, says Angie, ending up either being told to stop interviewing or else feeling frustrated because that other person talks only about themselves and didn't ask a single question about me.
So when you hit the ones where no one asks you a question about you because you have mad skills on making it about them, the last technique in my first book, The 10 Techniques to Quick Rapport, is manage expectations. I literally put that one in there for my wife. My wife is one of the world's beautiful people that'll ask you all about you, your family, your kids, everything that's going on in your life. And she'll get back in the car, come back home, and so annoyed that no one asked her one question about her. And I was like, because you're too good. So when you give the great gift of validation to others, manage your own expectations. Take joy in the fact that you gave a gift, not that you're going to get one back.
There we go. In fact, that was number 10. I was about to get on to now the 10 quick steps for establishing trust. In an earlier book, is a little bit what I would say in technical language in your trade. But let's go through as many as we can in the time we've got left, or as interesting as they are. Establishing artificial time constraints. What is that?
That is it's a really funny little goofy one I stumbled across in a book many years ago. And so let's first encapsulate, what's the point of quick rapport? A quick rapport is to make someone feel safe really fast. And to make someone feel safe, we have to give as much power to them as we can. And so when you establish a time constraint, what you're doing, and whether it's stated or implied, you're letting the other person know there's an end in sight, which gives them a feeling of choice. And so you can either say, it's like, oh, I'm so sorry, I got to get back to work in like 30 seconds. May I ask you a quick question about where you purchased that? That's an example of, here's a time constraint, I got to get back to work. So you know it's going to be quick and it's over. It can be implied, saying you're standing next to someone in the queue. See, I know British words here, in the queue instead of the line at a checkout, you know, to purchase an item, or out of a restroom to go to the bathroom. That's an implied time constraint that, listen, we have a short period of time, it's going to end. As opposed to someone sitting down next to you at a pub and saying, hey, can I buy you a drink?
Yeah.
Shields up, when's this going to end and what do they want? So when a time constraint gives the other person a feeling of control, which makes them feel safer.
Yeah, so if somebody says, have you got a moment, and you say, I give you 2 minutes, then you can, although you might, you know, not have that constraint. That's a very interesting one. Put in an artificial time constraint. Accommodating nonverbals. Now, we talked about nonverbals a bit with Lena yesterday, and I think somebody said, can we have a whole session on nonverbals? So give us a bit more about that, Robin.
I am at the macro nonverbal level. And see, that even that right there.
Yes.
What you want from nonverbals when engaging human beings and trying to make them feel safe is to emanate safety. Open, accommodating, eyebrow, anything up and out is saying, I'm open and I'm here for you. I'm safe. Palms up, ventral displays are called, smiling, So real smile, not one that's pulled straight back. It's a real full facial smile. Like I have joy, congruence of it's in here and out here with seeing and engaging with you. A little head tilt that I've been having the entire time, exposing a carotid artery right here, saying I'm trusting the world not to rip out my jugular. Yeah. Eyebrow elevation is up. All these things are saying up and out. Mark Bowden is a great nonverbal expert, and he was on my show not too long ago. He had a great analogy to think about this when it comes to open nonverbals. He goes, think about being really, really cold outside. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like all bundled up. It's been rainy and wet and cold. And you come inside and you stand by a fire, nice warm fire. And you start taking your clothes off and opening up to absorb that warmth. That's what you want to do when accommodating nonverbals.
And when you're analyzing or just getting to know somebody and that thing, you can, somebody who's shy, for want of a better word, and they're sort of like this, assessing you. And then as the conversation goes, they go like this, you know that you're slowly getting through to them.
Yeah. And that's all we're doing is we're just establishing their normal.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing when we're doing behavioral assessment. Is I'm always just establishing what the normal world around me looks like. And then I'm just going to look for deviations from that. So if someone's shy, okay, there's no bad nonverbals. They're just indicators of how someone's feeling emotionally. And so if someone is more closed up or a little timid at a first engagement, okay, that because that's them in the moment. But if you have a great conversation, the key here is tempo. You have to go according to their tempo, because if you start pushing the tempo according to how fast you want them to, who's it now about? It's about me. And all you're going to get is more of this.
Yeah. Slower rate of speech. I mean, you and I are both speaking quite quickly at the moment, but what does that mean?
It means don't be me. So they did a great study many years ago where they put, I think it was 15 women on one side of these blacked out screens, and they had about 90 males on the other side. And each one of these males had a different tenor, intonation, tempo of speech, and they had them each read the same paragraph. And on the other side where the women couldn't see them, the women that were listening, only listening, had to assess what they thought the individual looked like and whether they thought he was trustworthy or not. And without fail, the males that had some good late night FM voice, good tenor, modulation, and a slightly slower rate of speech for the demographic in which the female was in was 6'4", good looking, and very trustworthy. So what we're trying to do with a slower rate of speech is, one, we want to be clear and concise and heard so that we're not making people feel off because they don't understand what's being said. You also don't want to oversell what it is you're trying to do, because that just makes us feel really creepy. Because if you're speaking so fast that you're trying to get so much words in, it can be very off-putting. So slower rate of speech.
So just get, and also, as you know, we're told, just get one point over, however you wrap it. If you try to get 6 points over, then everybody forgets them all. Which reminds me of something I wanted to ask you now. It doesn't matter, in the middle of all this. You talked about the difference in types of relationships, a transactional relationship and a collaborative relationship.
Yes.
What is, give us that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really great, fantastic people in the world of human interaction, negotiation, crisis negotiation, Lena's stuff on elicitation. A lot of that is transactional because it's happening in a small space of time where you're going for limited data points and limited information. And so you're going to use the skills, tools, and techniques to establish quick trust, quick rapport. And it really kind of happens at a tactical level. People often ask me, so Robin, how's your stuff and trust and all that different? I said, well, I pick up where they leave off. In my world where I was recruiting spies and conducting these operations, things I did took up, there's literally one case. Matter of fact, in the book, The Code of Trust, I go through a Russian recruitment case that spanned my entire career of 22 years. Same individual. Because everyone operates at a different speed, different pain point, different priorities in life as they evolve and change. And so tactical is a great starting point. Quick rapport, elicitation, all those things happen at that strategic little level. And then you have to move beyond there. If you're going to be in charge of the flower show on the Village Green, that is not going to be a transactional relationship. That's going to be a long-term established relationship of trust.
Right. Okay. And to what extent is that connected to your number 8 point from your early thing, connect with the quid pro quo.
That's a great one that goes back to your question. If someone has a question for you, how much do you share and not overshare or not make it about you? And so what quid pro quo is about is like, it's giving someone an understanding of how we're connected. And so as you hear someone share an anecdote or story, because that's all we're doing as human beings, we're always sharing anecdote and story to have a connection and to assess. Think about this. We all have conversations where someone is curious about you and you share a little bit about your background, a little bit about the spy world or the books you read. And I share and I get the great Humphreys of the head tilt, the nod, the smiles, the people asking questions. Oh, you accept me for who I am. Let me share more. The problem is that you got to stop at some point and go back so I can hear what your anecdotes and stories are so I can say, oh, wow, we're similar. We're part of the same tribe. We have similar experiences because that makes us bond because we have this overlap. And so that's all we're doing. We're sharing anecdote or story. And quid pro quo, that technique is saying, hey, it's okay to identify commonalities, but don't overdo it so that you want to keep it in balance.
Yeah, okay. That gets back to Ange's earlier question. Can you wait where you are at the moment, Robin? Don't do a thing. I have to tell everybody what is coming up. Then we're going to come back to you. Angie has a final question, which is about, I think it's about, do you change the way you operate, whether you're here or whether you're in the States? But firstly, we have on March the 7th, Alistair Hignall on Purpose, Passion and Grit with Enid Bakewell, who's an international England cricketer who at 82 is still playing strong. And on March 9th, Lucinda, we go to the literary world on Inside Story with Rock and Roll, with the author Philip Clark, whose biography just out is of the legendary guitarist of the Kinks. That's Dave Davis, Living on a Thin Line. And he's currently writing a history of the sound in New York City. That'll be interesting. March 10th, that is the next day, I think that's next Friday, Lucinda guides us deep into the literary world with Natalie Jenner and her best-selling books, The Jane Austen Society and The Bloomsbury Girls. March 16th, I am with John and Mary James, who run an award-winning independent bookshop on the wild Suffolk coast, and they also founded the Aubra Literary Festival, which is starting this weekend, and have edited their own anthology of Suffolk writings. So if you want to know what it's like to run a bookshop and be the heart of a community, John and Mary are your people to have a conversation with there and to say this is Goldster, who never leaves you in the same comfort zone as Robin will apprise in a moment. We're going to go from cozy Suffolk and we're going to go to the deception and intrigue of Jack Barsky and his deep undercover, My Secret Life and Tangled Allegiances as a KGB spy in America. So instead of meeting Robin, the FBI counterintelligence expert, you're going to meet the spy that would have been working against Robin back in the Cold War and his types, because Jack worked as a Russian KGB, for the Russian KGB, lived undercover in America with a wife and children until he was eventually found out. You know Jack, do you, Robin?
Jack and I are great friends, yes. Jack's story is an amazing example of all the things we've been talking about. He grew up in East Germany right at the end of World War II. He grew up and was indoctrinated by the information he was given to believe that communism was the savior of the world and that the West was, get this, so I didn't know this, it was such an amazing thing. When he grew up in East Germany, he was told that the West and democracy was pro-Nazi. Hmm. Because at the end of World War II, the West placed the new chancellor of Germany was a Nazi sympathizer. And so that's what the Soviets and that's what everyone believed was the Western thing was pro-Nazi. And so that's what his thing was. He was going to save the world as a communist brother. And that was his indoctrination. He had no other choice. That was all that was fed him. So that's how he was recruited by the KGB as an East German. And as he was then deployed to the United States and started absorbing new information, his mindset completely shifted. He got a couple new families along the way and a couple of new kids.
But I have to ask you this, because we're in a different world now, and we have a new type of Russian enemy. We've got a Chinese enemy. We've got the Islamic extremism that you've dealt with. Can you imagine 20 years from now saying to any of those people that we are now up against, yes, they're a very, very good friend of mine?
Yeah, I can. It's I think it really depends on what we're exposed to and how the world evolves. You know, when you look at it, that's why, like you, I'm a great lover of history, and you can see the world, you know, there's four generations that typically exist on the planet at any one time. And so we're generally in 100-year cycles because the generation is about 25 years long. So if you look at the history and how things keep rotating through, yeah, I can imagine it. I think some of the extremism that people have, like deep indoctrination to really horrible things that human beings will do. So like extremism in any religion, Hitler's a great example of extremism when it came to his understanding of evolution, and Darwinism was way off base, you know? So in those cases, no, but in some of the cases, like an indoctrination through a Soviet or a communist way of thinking. Oh, absolutely.
It can happen. That is fascinating. And we are up to time and over time. Time's with Chariot, as we say, and it's coming up to 8 a.m. on the East Coast of America, where you have to go out and profile people and do your day job and write more books. But you definitely won me over as, I think, chairman of the village committee or the new kid on the block. And you've won over a few other people. And thank you all for your questions, comments, and for your analysis of Robin Dreeke. Until next week with Lucinda, where we get more insight into the world of rock and roll, stay socially interactive, join that committee, have tea with the Bedu tribesmen like Rosie Stancer is doing. My co-host is in the Sinai Desert at the moment. Mm. Stay curious, as Robin advises, stay safe, and of course, stay Goldster. Thank you, Robin Dreeke, for being such a brilliant guest with us in your early morning. Bye.
Thank you, Reed. Thank you, guests.
Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.